WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Well, we are in a jam today. Trouble is real. And whether we like it or not, we are in this mess together as a nation. When this word of the Lord came to Isaiah, his people were also in a jam.
The morning after the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, the Reverend William Barber delivered the homily for the inaugural prayer service. The prayer service, usually at the National Cathedral, follows the inauguration every 4 years. It's a given, part of the whole ceremony. But the event tells us something about a president's relationship with religion. And in that context, the fact that Reverend Barber was asked to give the homily was deeply significant. Barber is explicitly political in his ministry. He wants government policies to reflect Christian values. His agenda, though, is nearly the opposite of what the Christian right has successfully advanced for so many years in Washington.
Our democracy. We can't accept the poverty and low wealth of 140 million Americans before COVID and many more millions since. We must have a third Reconstruction. We must address the 5 interlocking injustices of systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, the war economy, and the false, distorted moral narrative of religious nationalism. These are breaches that must be addressed. And according to the text, repairing the breaches will bring revival.
Barber is firmly in the center, or more so on the left of the Democratic Party on matters of poverty, voting rights, gay rights, environmental protection, and more. And yet he expresses frustration, deep frustration with the party. He thinks it lacks a coherent, inspiring moral vision to reach the country. Barber is pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and he's president of a group called Repairers of the Breach. He and I spoke in 2017, not so long after the election of Donald Trump, a very different turning point in our nation's history.
Now, you've written, "I can't remember a time when I did not know God both to be real and to be about bringing justice in the world," and yet you had what you call serious reservations about the church. What were those reservations?
Yeah, two different things. I can't remember a time when God, sense of God, was not formative in my reality, but my father did have some struggle, even within the church, the so-called black church, because there were persons who would say to him, "We don't need to be involved in politics. We just need to pray and have praise services and, you know, and just don't be involved." You know, Dr. King faced the same thing. And, you know, Dr. King was put out of his denomination because of that. So I struggled with that. I said, well, maybe I'll be a lawyer, an attorney. And when I got ready to go to college, I actually looked at the catalogs to make sure there weren't any courses on religion required.
You had your fill, you thought?
Well, of that. Not of God, not of justice, not of love, but the formalized kind of. I was hurting, and I was hurting because of some of the things I'd seen. And then somewhere down the line, had a real strong epiphany. And actually, one day I called my father and said, "Daddy, I'm wrestling with something." He said, "Come home, I already know." I said, "You already know what?" He said, "I already know, just come home." And when I went home, we went driving, and he took me down to Nag's Head and around the beach, and we just drove along the coast of the ocean and talked. And we talked about, you know, theology. We talked about the church. The church is not a perfect entity. You know, whether or not my work should be inside or outside, the difference between the church as an imperfect entity and the reality of God and reality of justice, reality of love. And I revealed to him that I felt a calling to ministry and preached my trial sermon in March of 1984.
Now, the Black church writ large has been a sanctuary, a place of truth-telling, a place of relative safety since for hundreds of years. And at the same time, particularly in the South, but not only, the evangelical white church has been growing more and more right-wing now for decades. Now, as a young man, did you start sensing this tension between your own church and the growing moral majority and all the other evangelical movements that were growing?
You've used a lot of terms that I don't use the same way. So it's going to take me a little bit to pat that.
I've got all night.
Okay. First of all, I'm an evangelical. The Black church has been traditionally evangelical. The term was hijacked because in the Bible, theologically, there's no such thing as an evangelical that does not begin with a critique of systems of economic injustice. And when Jesus, the ultimate evangelical, right, that brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, that was born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth, the ghetto, right, the poor place, his first sermon said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news." That's evangel. That's what that means. To the poor. If your attention is not on dealing with the issues that hurt the poor, the brokenhearted, the sick, the left out, the least of these, the stranger, and all of those who are made to feel unacceptable, you don't have white right-wing evangelicalism. You have heresy.
Is that what you would call?
Yes. Yeah. You have theological malpractice. It doesn't fit Orthodox Christianity. What we've had.
But let's break it down for a second. How do you account for the fact that Donald Trump, whose behavior and rhetoric and past is in no way a moral avatar, and his interest in religion is of recent vintage, and yet his support was extremely high in that community, broadly defined.
That's right. By that particular group, it was opposed in many ways. But yes, okay, and that's where you see now. I think where we can see it so clearly. Those Kevin Cruz in his book and others have documented this. When they wanted to speak against, for instance, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, and they wanted to take over elements of the Christian pulpit, they came up with this weird theology. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. If you're good, you're wealthy. If you're bad, you're in poverty. It's actually a strange form of Calvinism that just is abusive to Calvinism in itself.
Calvinism with private planes.
No. Right. And so.
Does Creflo Dollar bother you in that way?
Or any of those that simply preach in that way, because it is not consistent with Orthodox theology. It's not consistent with the theology of the Bible. It's not consistent with the critique. But let me make
but
one
how
point.
Did, but how did Trump get such wise
well,
support?
Well, that's what I'm saying. But if in fact, then your theology says whoever is good is wealthy, then you would fawn over a wealthy businessman, right? Because his purse strings...
Despite his moral behavior.
Despite his moral behavior. Because maybe the religion you're promoting isn't really about moral behavior. Maybe it's really a purchased religion, like paid puppets of the empire. Because anytime a religion seems to say the only moral issues are prayer in the school, where you stand on abortion, being against a woman's right to choose, private property, and making sure you can prove that Jesus was a founding member of the NRA, that is not Christianity. Think about it. This is how you can see it, my brother Remnant. They're so loud on things like abortion and prayer in the school, and so wrong and so quiet on things like health care and living wages and acceptance of all people and treating the poor. Now, there are 3,500 scriptures in the Bible about love and justice and mercy and how you treat the stranger and how you help the least of these. And it's not talking about private charity either. It's talking about how we shape society. It's talking about the nations. Jesus said, "When I will say to the nations when I was hungry," not to individuals, to the nations. That's governments. 3,500 scriptures. There may be three scriptures about homosexuality. None of them trump the scripture that says you got to love your neighbor as yourself. So how do you claim to be a conservative if you dismiss 3,500 texts, but then build a whole theology around three scriptures and most of them you misinterpret? That's not conservative. That's not, because conservative means to hold on to the essence of.
How do you deal with a complex moral issue like abortion in your church, where I would bet there's not unanimity in the pews?
It's not unanimity. First of all, one of the things we say to people is, first of all, let's get the folk out of the room for a minute. We love them. But who want to come in here and talk about a woman's right to choose, and they claim they want the baby to be here, but then they don't want to give the woman health care to get the baby here, or health care to the baby after the baby gets here. They don't want to pay the parents a living wage so they can take care. So you really don't have any credibility to talk about abortion, because all of your policies abort people's possibilities, dreams, and hope. So you don't need to be in this conversation. Secondly, it's easy. You can be, I'm not pro-abortion. You know, like, man, say, just go out and that's not even, we shouldn't, it's not pro or con. I can say that I believe in life. I want persons to have children. But there are so many situations where that may not be possible. There are situations where people have to choose. And even if they choose to have an abortion, I choose to love. I choose to care for them. What I want to get the conversation to higher ground. And the higher ground is, how do we stop aborting the hopes of the poor? How do we stop destroying healthcare? You think about the hypocrisy of having clergy in the Rose Garden with the president clapping for him signing an executive order about so-called religious leaders and not chastising him on his position to deny millions of people healthcare. And they claim to be Christian clergy. Now watch this. This is a very simple country boy analogy. If I'm not mistaken, the one thing Jesus did was set up free health clinics. I mean, everywhere you look in the Bible, Jesus healing folk. He never charged a leper a copay. Now, you believe in Jesus now. You believe in Jesus. But you're going to applaud someone? Something else is going on underneath that's ugly, that's cynical, that doesn't make sense, that's not good for the health of our culture, and as a denial of the basics of our faith. You know, the word salvation means healing.
Reverend, your most recent book is called The Third Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. In it, you argue that this country needs what you call a third reconstruction in order to save the soul of America. Tell me what you mean by that.
I actually believe that much of what we're seeing, we're in the birth pains of a third reconstruction, and those who are the adversaries of America reconstructing itself, and who in many ways are the social and political descendants of those who've always fought Reconstruction, they see it happening. If you know history, you understand that what we've seen with Donald Trump is as American as apple pie. It's the call and response of history. The call is more justice, more racial progress. The response is the progress of racism, the fear, and the reaction. And what should surprise us is not so much that Donald Trump used these tactics, but that he and others, Ryan McConnell and others, have been so successful at using them in the 21st century. And one of the reasons I've been writing about the Third Reconstruction is because I think too often too many people do not know this history. do not know this history.
You think we're too caught up in the day-to-day hysteria of what's going on?
Sometimes, and just, we keep dumbing down politics. We need to understand this history because actually we're seeing it played out. What do we have now? The cry against, for tax cuts. What helped to bring it into the second Reconstruction? Cry about tax cuts. First Reconstruction, the cry about tax cuts, because the tax cut was always about disabling the government from being able to make the playing field more level and fixing the problems that the government created in the first
place.
So this
brings us to your role. Yeah. Now, you've just changed your life a little bit. You've left your job in the North Carolina NAACP.
I laugh when you say job because I see some
folks. It's work.
It's a volunteer. You know, people don't realize that. The president of the NAACP is work, but it's volunteer. It's purely love, volunteer.
But it's been replaced by something that's potentially much larger, which is to lead a poor people's movement. What does that movement mean?
First of all, last year, from April to November, I did a tour with Dr. James Forbes, former emeritus, pastor emeritus of Riverside, Dr. Liz Theo Harris from Union, Sister Simone Tracy Blackman. We did 22 states, called it the Moral Revival Tour, and we put out a higher ground moral agenda. Thousands of people showed up. Hundreds of clergy activists, even people who are not people of faith but who believe in the moral arc of the universe, showed up to be trained in moral activism, moral articulation, and moral analysis. It showed us that there was a heart that people know we need, as I said, the convention, some moral defibrillators, people who are willing to say, wait a minute, some of these issues are not about left versus right, they're about right versus wrong. Healthcare is about right versus wrong. Living wage is right versus wrong. Dealing with systemic racism is about right versus wrong. And that we need to stand up not as partisans, but as people of conscience. Something's wrong in the spirit of the country. And we knew that we needed to have this poor people's campaign. So we decided, when it comes to prophetic voices, Brother Remnant, you don't simply have commemorations of what they did. I'm kind of tired of commemorations now. Well, we go back and say, back then they did this. You figure out how to reimagine and re-engage what they did and what was the unfinished business.
You've had a movement called the Moral Monday Movement as of 2013, I believe.
Actually, the Forward Together Moral Movement started in 2007 when Democrats were in office. And I want to talk about that because a moral movement can't just challenge extremists who've taken over the Republican Party. We have to challenge reluctant Democrats. And especially right now, I'm very concerned when I hear Democrats talking only about the middle class. They think that's all that went wrong in this past election. One of the things we have to do is recover our moral foundation. When some of these extremists say they want to read the Constitution, I get happy. I said, please, let's read the Constitution. Or when they say we wanna talk about what's in the Bible, please, let's have that conversation. Because if we have it, then it will expose the holes in the hypocrisy and may even cause you to repent.
Reverend Barber,
come join us in love.
The church, and not only the black church, but the church and religion. Were a huge impetus to the civil rights movement. And there were lots of leaders of the civil rights movement, lots of factions and differences of opinion, all the rest. Is the church in the same position that it was in 1954 through the late 60s now to be that moral underpinning? When I went, I was in Charleston, South Carolina after those terrible murders and spent a lot of time at that church. But when I spoke to younger people in Black Lives Matter movement, it was well outside the church structure. There was a real gap between the older folks in the church, and distinctly older, and the younger movement that was well outside the church. Is that a complication for today's movement?
Well, you know, I'd like love you to talk to all the young people that are part of the Moral Monday movement, and many of them are Black Lives Matter and many other groups. See, I have, again, we're having a little linguistic thing, because to say the church has always been problematic. You know, the church has always been problematic.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Is the progressive movement, broadly defined, more secular than it was a half century ago?
I think that progressives made a mistake when they walked away from the centerpieces of faith and morality because they were mad with Jerry Falwell, you know. I think progressives make a mistake when we don't know and remember the power of moral underpinning and what power has been. Now, I'm not talking about a movement that says you have to be Christian. That's the genius of the Moral Monday movement. There are people in who are atheists that come to our rallies and say, amen. What we found is that there are these deep moral foundations that transcend our limits. They transcend our limits. We have figured out a way in North Carolina, and what we figured out on the moral revival, if you look at the groups that came and at all our revivals, we had Black Lives Matter, we had, you know, environmentalists, we had Fight for 15. In fact, one time in Birmingham, we were in a Jewish synagogue downtown training 200 activists. We had Muslims, Christians, Jews in a Jewish synagogue, Black Lives Matter, people not of faith, charismatics, policy people, gay and straight, all in the same room all day long. And I think that we make a big mistake. When I see progressives now, and I love so many of them, talking about all we got to do is work on the white work middle class. And they're not talking about expanding the electorate. When they give every reason for this election, but without dealing with the issue of race. You know, I've said to a group the other day on this election, if you know the history of Reconstruction, not only do you know what has happened as American as apple pie, you know how to defeat it. It's when we come together. When we're willing to put our minds to work and our bodies on the line. What if we didn't focus on Trump? Because Trump is a symptom. And what if we said this is not the end of a movement, but a launching the movement? And what if we said we will work in our silos sometimes, but we want you to know we're all in this together. And we stand on our deepest moral principles and not just curse the darkness, but point people to the light. What if we used something like that to literally shock the very heart of this nation? I want to see what would happen if we finished that leg of the poor people's campaign. I want to see what would happen if we could come together. And I believe Walter Wink was a great theologian at Union Theological Seminary. He wrote a sermon, I remember reading some years ago, called The Blessings of an Enemy. And this is going to sound strange. Don't y'all get mad. Let me finish. Sometimes you have to look at what your enemy did to defeat you to find your strength. If the forces in this last election, this is not just this last election, this has been a 40-year battle. If, however, in order to win, they had to lie almost every other 10 minutes, they had to find a way to put pornographic sums of money into the electoral pot. They had to spend years pushing voter suppression. They had to use fear against Muslims, against immigrants. If somebody cheats you, they don't cheat you because you're weak. People only cheat you when they can't beat you in a fair fight. Then that says that we are stronger than we realize. And this is not the worst thing we've ever faced. People made it through slavery. People made it through the denial of women's rights. People made it through the depression in this country. People made it through apartheid and Jim Crow. It's our time to stand up and be the moral dissenters, the moral defibrillators, and the moral dreamers, and to make it through this moment and use it to change the course of history, to change America. And in some ways, if we work together, we'll change the world.
Reverend Barber, thank you. Thank you very much. I spoke with William Barber in 2017. He's the pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church, president of Repairers of the Breach, and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. In a moment, we'll look at Joe Biden's faith. He's only the second Catholic president ever, and how it may shape his leadership.
I found that there's that famous phrase from Kierkegaard, faith sees best in the dark. I find the one thing it gives me, and I'm not trying to proselytize, I'm not trying to convince you to share my religious views. But for me, it's important because it gives me some reason to have hope and purpose.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It comes as something of a surprise to remember that President Biden is only the second Catholic to hold the office out of 46 people so far. The first, of course, was John Kennedy. And whether that has any significance to his policies or his leadership is a question that I wanted to ask Paul Eli. Paul writes for us frequently about the Catholic Church and issues of faith, and he's a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Now, Paul, I think we're long past time when discrimination against Catholics was a real force in America. But what do you make of the fact that Biden is only the second Catholic president?
What I think is just how clearly it reveals how dramatically things have changed since Kennedy was elected in 1960. At that moment, you had Franco in power in Spain. You had the church tightly wound in with governments in the countries from which so many American Catholics had come, in Italy and Ireland. The church was deeply tied into governments in Latin America. There was fear that something like that could happen here. That said, I don't think the animus against Kennedy really was about that. I think it was a holdover of a long nativism of American Protestants against Catholics that led the KKK to identify papists as others, as people not like us. So here we are some years later, and I don't think anyone's concerned that the Pope is going to give Joe Biden an order that he must follow. And in some ways, it's rich that actually the people who historically fear such scenarios, people on the left, are now looking to Biden to bring his religion into the mix.
In a way, they want to see some of Pope Francis brought into the mix.
I think that's right. One of the things that distinguishes Biden's Catholicism is that it's not doctrinaire. It tries to make common cause with people of different groups. And he has that in common with Pope Francis. And so there's the hope that Francis's openness, his informality, his flexibility, his confidence that Catholicism is relevant and lack of anxiety about its place in any culture war is going to inform Biden's approach to Catholicism as president.
So where do you see the evidence that Biden's religious values, his religious practice, shape his policies?
It's hard to tell. And that's perturbed a lot of people on the right. And it's given a lot of anxiety to certain Catholic bishops who are already concerned that his executive orders go against Catholic teaching, that he's about to enshrine a kind of take-it-or-leave-it Catholicism as legitimate in this country. What I see is something much more obvious but no less important. Biden values institutions. He has a concern for the common good. He likes to speak a language that others speak. And in this case, the language that he speaks that enables him to make common cause with others often has a religious accent. The common good, my brother's keeper, welcome the stranger, and so forth. It's at that level that he can strike a religious note and both embolden people on the left and possibly reach out to people on the right.
Now, I think it's safe to say that Joe Biden is a more devout Christian than his predecessor, certainly a more practicing one, although Trump remains a huge favorite among evangelical voters, despite his not being terribly observant, to say the least. Have American Catholics had the same devotion to Trump?
It breaks down in different ways. Among white Catholics, especially in the heartland, there's a really considerable support for Trump. It's baffled a lot of people. I'm personally baffled by it. What I think is really clear is that there's an equally substantial number of Catholics who are not only supportive of Biden, but are ready to move forward and coalesce around Biden if he can make a few bold moves in policy in his early months and do it in a way that reflects not just a concern for Catholicism, but suggests that he's speaking as one of them.
Biden seemed reluctant earlier in his career to invoke faith in any blatant, obvious way, and he's been more demonstrative about that in later years. Why is that?
Well, David, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One has to do with his personal story. The death of his son, Beau, led him to speak more forthrightly about grief. And then the historical context has changed since the 80s. In the 80s, it was the right, and especially the Catholic right, who urged public officials to conform public policy to their Catholic beliefs. Over the past three decades, things have turned in the opposite way, where now you have a Supreme Court justice like Amy Coney Barrett actually insisting during her confirmation hearings that her very deeply held Catholicism will not affect her rulings from the bench. And Biden, on the other side, is more and more comfortable speaking of faith because the ground has softened and faith as public policy is part of the lingua franca of our time.
But isn't that just a difference in the jobs they hold? A Supreme Court justice has to, you know, bob and weave through his or her hearings, whereas a presidential candidate is appealing at a different level.
That's definitely the case. I guess, and this is almost a question for you, I think that President Obama helped now President Biden open up his vocabulary in matters of faith. Barack Obama was very articulate, very convincing on the role that Christianity had played in his life, and then spoke with great power after the church massacre, for example. This showed that a person could speak from the heart on matters of faith without being governed by faith or a slave to faith. And I think Biden was right by his side and picked up on that. What do you think?
Well, I don't really know. President Obama's religion has always been a kind of mystery to me, not that it necessarily should be an open matter, because he was clearly committed to the church he was committed to. But in many ways, it seemed a matter of community as much as it did traditional religious faith.
And I think that that's more true of Biden than maybe we've detected. Yes, he goes to Mass on Sundays. Yes, he carries a rosary. But in a very deep way, he belongs to a Catholic community in the broadest sense. Mm. This is tens of millions of people who identify with Catholicism in some way, whether it's a childhood influence, something they practice now, something that is part of where they came from. And that sense of community expressed in general language such as he uses is really an effective part of his self-presentation. I think it means a lot to him.
Within the Catholic Church, there's so much tension between a liberal-leaning pope, Pope Francis, and a hierarchy of bishops that's become, if anything, more conservative over time, to a non-Catholic. It's really startling how openly opposed many senior leaders are to Francis, and now we've got a president who is kind of a Francis-type Catholic. How is that going to play out in the political realm, if you can tell?
I think the first thing to keep in mind is that the church and American society are in different circumstances. In America, we're yearning for unity. We feel that we've gone down the road of division as far as we can go, and we need someone to kind of help pull things together. The church, there's been a sham or surface unity that's been observed or imposed for decades and for centuries. Pope Francis has opened things up, and we're now hearing voices of dissent and disagreement that were sotto voce or behind closed doors in previous generations. So a consequence of Francis's openness is the very open disagreements that we're seeing now, and in some ways they're a good thing.
You know, it's interesting to me that some of the ideological backbone of Trumpism, both historically with Pat Buchanan and in contemporary terms with William Barr, comes with particularly conservative Catholics.
I think that's right, and I think the fact of the Second Vatican Council and the history of the Church over the past half century has made it easy to forget just for how long the Catholic Church was the anti-liberal institution, one that was ruled by a quasi-monarch that insisted doctrinally and practically that it could not change, that maintained ties to all sorts of older forms of European absolutism after they were broken down by democracy. And that history is still very powerful for so many people. In a way, that's the history that I think was in play at the Capitol on January 6th. We saw a rugged wooden cross present in that mob like a battering ram. Mm. We saw quasi-crusading imagery and a guy claiming the Senate chamber like a conquistador and saying, you know, this space is ours now. That's very old Christian history that's not gone, that's still in play.
Now, the greatest challenge that I think the Catholic Church has faced in the last generation is the abuse scandals, which are so horrific, and there are so many of them. Has Biden taken any firm position on those scandals and the church's culpability?
I don't know Biden's position in particular. I know that it's the fact of the scandals that's shaping so much of the response to his Catholicism right now. Obviously, Catholics and progressive Catholics especially are yearning for some good news after three decades of bad news. At the same time, the leaders of the church, the bishops, are sorely lacking in moral authority because of three decades of complicity in really criminal behavior, the sexual abuse of minors by Catholic priests. With their credibility low, the chance for a different kind of Catholic figure, one who has a kinship to Pope Francis in attitude and a lot of his positions, I mean Joe Biden, is moving into the breach and suggesting that there is still some moral authority left in this tradition.
Paul Eli, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
You can read Paul Eli on Biden's faith, the Catholic Church, and much more at newyorker.com. Paul's a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Kurt Weill was a co-founder of the rock band The War on Drugs. But he left the band shortly after its debut to make records all on his own. And they're sometimes characterized as slacker rock. His recent EP is called Speed, Sound, Lonely KV.
She's deliciously tall, sort of a long girl. She's delightfully small, sort of a song girl.
Kurt Vile, that's V-I-L-E, it's his real name, has also appeared on the comedy show Portlandia and on HBO's animated series Animals, where he played a singing squirrel. Vile came to the New Yorker Festival in 2018 to talk with our critic Amanda Petrusich.
You were a clue on Jeopardy last year. This is one of my favorite Kurt Vile facts.
Well, it's college Jeopardy.
Well, it's kind of a weird clue. The clue was the violators assist this pretty pimpin' rocker in his foul work.
Yeah. He's the Riddler. Like, how nobody could even understand. Even if they knew the answer, they'd be like, wait, what?
It was a complicated
clue. Going on there.
Nonetheless, I would imagine being a Jeopardy clue has to be some sort of milestone. That's got to be super weird. Who was the first person who told you?
You don't know her.
You grew up one of 10 children. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in your family?
Yeah, it was pretty annoying. No, it was pretty cool, but it was like no space, you know, for like the boys' room had 5 boys in it. Because of that, I can like sleep through anything and I can just tune in and out whenever, you know, whenever people are talking, I can like be listening or not.
And now you yourself have got 2 young daughters. How would you characterize yourself as a parent?
Father of the year. No, it's awesome having kids, and they're still pretty young, and they're really into music and reading, and yeah, they're total brats in the best way.
Do they like your songs?
Yeah, like the one, my oldest, Awilda, she like listens intensely to words, and the youngest, Delphine, she'll go straight to a piano or guitar and just start playing. So,
when did you start writing songs?
Well, I started playing a string instrument, like a banjo, when I was 14. I probably started writing songs right around then, but I made my first like cassette when I was 17. I would put out a tape or a CDR, but I would call it my album as if it was like really, really, you know. But they didn't really become real albums until I was 28. But
Did you make your own cover art
CDRs? Yeah, yeah.
I used to do that for mixed CDs. So the banjo was your first instrument, and that's kind of what you learned to write on?
Yeah, my dad wished I was like a bluegrass musician. So like a year before, maybe when I was 13, he hung it over my head later. He's like, we were going to get you a guitar for Christmas, but you were really bad this year. So the next year, he's like, I could get you this banjo. And I wasn't sure, but then he worked for SEPTA, like drove trains, and a conductor, he basically was going to buy the banjo off this conductor, and the conductor played it over the phone, you know, the telephone, not the cellophone. And it sounded really cool through the telephone. So I was like, all right. But I kind of just treated it like a guitar. I just strum it. But yeah.
Who are some of your favorite songwriters?
So many. Let's see. You know, there's like the classics, of course, like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, and then there's like Townes Van Zandt.
Well, you had the chance to open for Neil Young last year.
John Prine. Yes, I opened for Neil Young recently. It was pretty funny. I was terrified. There was like 80,000 people. And,
wow.
And I just kind of like what I'm doing now, but with the guitar in my hand. It's like, I came out real cocky. I was like joke singing like some kind of Stevie Nicks thing. And then I was like, I got the crystal vision. And then I was like...
Did you get a chance to meet Neil?
I met him multiple times, but only for a split second. And the best time was a couple times before I got backstage. It was the first time I saw him with Promise of the Real. And these kids, Willie Nelson's sons and other kids, they back him up really good. And I weaseled my way backstage with my wife, Suzanne, and she egged me on to like say hi. And so I did. And I was like, oh... Neil, I've seen you like 10 times, and it's always amazing, but this was the best by far, Down by the River, which was like 30 minutes long. I was like, it's like you were underground in outer space at the same time. It was unbelievable. And he was like, he was smiling all nice, and then when I said that, he was like, oh, yeah, we can go in outer space whenever we want. and then I got a picture with him. That was cool. every time I see him, it's where he just played a show. And even if we have friends in common, it doesn't matter because you're just like, ah, I'm still a fanboy. But this last time, his bandmates, I'm hugging all of them. They, like, in between, they're all passing around a jazz cigarette. I'm usually scared to do this. I used to love it as a kid, and then I can't. It's harder to deal with it, but I'm trying. But but anyway, I grabbed it from the drummer, and me and my wife tried it out for the first time ever. No, just kidding. But then, anyway, they came off the stage, and we're feeling really weird, and everybody's sort of just around him. And then he's just about to get away, as he usually does. And then I was like, well, I should just give him this Sadie CD, which is my friend's that we have. He knows who the Sadies are, and usually I'm just, it just makes more sense than being like, hi, I'm Kurt Vile again. So I was like, I'll just give him this Sadie CD. So I literally jumped down, and I was like, hey, Neil, you get the new Sadies? And then everybody was like, ah! And they all, and like his manager, Elliot Roberts, he's a legend, but he's old now, and he was like about to check me like a hockey player. But then I got it to him, though.
There is I think, a dryness and a kind of absurdist humor to a lot of your lyrics that I just find so sort of intoxicating and beguiling. Some of it recalls, I mean, you mentioned Dylan, you mentioned John Prine, I think two lyricists and writers who do this really well. A line like, girl, you gave me rabies, and I don't mean maybe.
Yeah, well.
I mean, how do you sort of think about lyrics in relation to rhythm or in relation to melody, and kind of where does the lyric writing fall within your songwriting process?
Well, and I don't mean maybe. I plagiarize from like Bo Diddley or other people, you know, they always say that, or other bloops people they say, and I don't mean maybe. And then,
they don't
and, then,
it with
and
rabies.
Then the girl you gave me rabies, that's a true story. So.
How did you get rabies, Kurt?
From a girl.
I'm not buying this.
Well.
Is this like rabies the new mom?
No, I'm lying.
It's the kissing
I'm
disease?
Lying.
I figured. Why don't we hear some music?
Okay. All right.
This morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I laughed and I said, oh, silly me, that's just me. Then I proceeded to brush some stranger's teeth, but they were my teeth, and I was weightless, quivering like some leaf come in the window of a restaurant. I couldn't tell you what the hell it was supposed to mean, cause it was a Monday, not Tuesday, not Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Then Saturday came around and I said, who that stupid clown blocking my bathroom sink? All he ever wanted was to be someone in life that was just like all I wanted, to just have fun, live my life like a son of a gun. I could be 1,000 miles away, but mean what I said. Then I woke up this morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I laughed and I said, silly me, that's just me. Then I proceeded to knock home some strangers. Here never was my style. But I couldn't tell you what the hell it was supposed to mean, cause it was a Monday, not Tuesday, not Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Then Saturday came around and I said, who that stupid clown blocking my bathroom sink? But he was sporting all my clothes, the guy say pretty pimping. Thank you.
did. All he ever wanted was to be a man, but he was always a little too cute to be a man, and the mom was lost. He was always a thousand miles away while standing in front of your face. Then he woke up this morning, didn't recognize a boy in the mirror. Laughed and said, "Silly me, that's just me." Then I proceeded to brush some stranger's teeth, but they were my teeth, and I was weightless, quivering like some leaf come in the window of a rest. I couldn't tell you what the hell it was supposed to mean, 'cause it was a Monday, not Tuesday, not Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Then Saturday came around and I said, "Who that stupid clown blocking my bathroom sink?" But he was sporting all my clothes that got say pretty pimping. Baba Uma Man Man.
Kurt Weill from a live performance in 2018 at the New Yorker Festival. His new album is called Speed, Sound, Lonely KV, and he talked with Amanda Petrusich. You can read her on Music All the Time at NewYorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for joining us as always. And if you want to keep in touch, find us on Twitter at New Yorker. Be well.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
With additional help from Joe Plord.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.